No sound.
Let's run this son of a gun till 8 o'clock tonight. I don't want to get out of here. I don't have to drive.
There we go.
Just stay here.
I'd like to bring the House Committee to, on Consumer Protection to order Friday, April 10th. We have on our agenda House Bill 3085. It's being carried over until Monday. So first up, I'd like to have, looking to see who's here. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2307 and have Mr. David Niebel come forward, please.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Victoria, would you give us a brief review of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2307 creates an exception to the definition of collection agency for a person that receives an assignment of debt without obligation to pay the assigner any of the proceeds resulting from the collection of the debt.
Thank you. And we first had a public hearing on this bill.
February 11th.
So, Mr. Niebel, if you'd identify yourself for the record and give us a little description of exactly what this bill does, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Niebel. I work for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here on behalf of the debtor-creditor section of the bar. This bill deals with debt buyers, people who buy the right to collect the debt from the original creditor. They collect the debt directly from the debtor. They are not a collection agency. Under the relevant statutes for the regulation of collection agencies under the Department of Business Services, Consumer Business Services, that statute doesn't specifically require them to register as a collection agent, but case law, which was decided within the last several years in bankruptcy court, requires them to register as collection agent, as a collection agent, in order to collect the debt directly against the debtor. The reason that the section is bringing this bill is that the registration with DCBS doesn't do anything to protect the debtor, because the regulation that DCBS does is between the collection agency and the collection agency's client, the person on whose behalf the collection agency is collecting the debt. They don't have anything to do with regulating the way that the debt is collected by either the collection agency or a debt buyer with respect to the debtor. So they don't, the debt buyer is required to, by this case, to register as a collection agent when there's no real effect to that. And so what this bill would do is explicitly say that in order to collect a debt, the debt buyer is not required to register as a collection agency.
Thank you. Pretty straightforward, I think. Does anybody have any questions about this? Representative Krieger.
Then David, thank you, Mr. Chair. We were all operating under the assumption, and the judge changed the assumption.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I believe that is the case.
Any other questions? Representative Cowan.
Mr. Chair, I understand that the relationship between collection agencies and creditor and how this wouldn't fit, but does there then continue to be any sort of regulatory oversight of debt buyers? That's what I'm unclear on, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, yes, the debt buyer is and has always been subject to the Oregon Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act and is also subject, I believe, to the Federal Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act, or whatever that is exactly called. And this bill does not change that at all. And as you have dealt with Senate Bill 328, I believe, this session, that gives the Attorney General the right to enforce those at the Oregon Act against debt buyers.
Okay. That regulation includes debt buyers. I'm sorry, follow up. That regulation then will include debt buyers. Just, I'm sorry, I needed to refresh my memory. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions on this particular piece? Thank you for your presentation on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
I heard something.
Chair, I'd move House Bill 2307. Move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Winger moves House Bill 2307 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I really don't understand the motion because I couldn't hear it.
Representative Winger moves House Bill 2307 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Discussion? Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2307, Hammer, received required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barton, would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2307. I'm going to recess for just a couple seconds, please. Order, and that includes out there. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3020. Victoria, give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3020 makes knowingly taking advantage of disabled veteran, service member, or spouse unconscionable tactic and unlawful trade practice.
And I'd like to have Representative Matthews present the bill for us. Representative Matthews, welcome to our committee this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Always a pleasure. Chair Holby and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I am the state representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham. House Bill 3020 is a co-chief-sponsored event with myself and Representative Freeman. It is kind of a partnership with our wonderful Attorney General's office, Attorney General Kroger. And it comes to you in a means of protecting our veterans. I will address just briefly the amendments themselves, not to be confused. We were looking for the term deployed in the bill to cover our veterans as they're deployed. It later came back from Legislative Council, which I trust their opinion, of course, that since there's no definition that specifically meets the need for deployed, it would be best to stay consistent with other language that's in other bills of service member. And so with that, that's really what that does, is puts that back in line with what's consistent with the deployment of our soldiers, calling them service members. There are some folks from the AG's office here that will be addressing that, as well as our wonderful military soldiers. But essentially, what this will do is it's It's for those folks that are, it'll especially protect our veterans from unconscionable tactics. It'll put it under the UTPA. And I think there's an urgency on this. Again, I've talked before about the deployment of our soldiers. We'll have 3,000 leaving us within a month. While they're departing, they are extremely vulnerable. They're vulnerable to a lot of folks out there. And again, I don't think the industry is flooded with these bad actors, but I do think they exist. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of our soldiers, because there is no differential pay, a lot of our soldiers are making less wages in the military than they do in their regular jobs. So when they do leave to serve our great nation and they're gone, their families are suffering a great deal from the lost wages. It makes them extremely vulnerable, again, to some folks that might be trying to force themselves in bad ways upon our veterans or service members and their spouses. So with that being said, this bill comes to you to address that, give the authority for the Attorney General to treat them under the UTPA. It's for the unconscionable tactics and add specially protected for our disabled vets, spouses, and our deployed vets known as active service members.
Thank you. Seeing no questions for you, we have a couple other. Were there? I didn't see any.
Well, it doesn't have to be Representative Matthews. Is there somebody more familiar with the technical aspects of the bill?
There will be some folks from the AG's office, yes. And
thank you. So if we could get those folks to come up, that would be great.
I think I should go at him.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Paul Sundermeyer. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in Attorney General John Kroger's Department of Justice now. And this is David Kramer. I asked David, who's an attorney in charge of the employment section, to help me out in case you have any specific questions about the Service Members Civil Relief Act, because he has a lot of experience having been a judge advocate general in the Air Force. So he's more familiar with the federal law than I am. Representative Matthews explained the purpose of the bill. It also, besides treating as an unconscionable tactic, taking advantage of a disabled veteran or service member as defined now in the -1 amendment, it also incorporates portions of the Serviceman Members Civil Relief Act into Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And what we're doing is trying to identify similar kinds of consumer protection measures in the service, I'll call it the SCRA, it's easier to say, from the SCRA into our UTPA, thereby giving what rights you would have normally under a federal law into state law, which is a little easier to deal with if you're an Oregon resident. You can deal with violations of the state law. To be clear, and I did put this in my handout, the change to the definition of unconscionable tactic to include taking advantage of a disabled service, disabled veteran or a service member with this added definition will make it a deployed service member. That is enforceable by the Attorney General or any district attorney where the activity might occur. So it's a special provision of the UTPA because it looks for some special protection. The other portion of the bill that we recommend is the change adding the SCRA into the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that is enforceable both as a private right of action and by prosecuting attorney, meaning any district attorney or the attorney general. You'll see if you look on the second page of my testimony, I had a few amendments. The first one you can just ignore now that we've seen legislative councils come up with another proposal for delineating service member as a deployed service member, and I think that'll work fine. This was an alternative that we had suggested. But I think legislative council is just fine, and we would recommend that. The other amendments I suggest are kind of housekeeping things I think would be of help to the law. On the bill is Section 3, capital LLL. That's the last portion of the law. It's where it talks about the violation SCRA being also a violation of UTPA, we ought to make clear that it does not include all of the provisions of the SCRA unless you really intend to do that. The initial proposal we thought was for specific consumer protection parts and not necessarily all of the SCRA. So we would think that including but not limited to should come out of there, and then add on to the back of it the words as in effect on the effective date of this act. That way the SCRA that's being incorporated is the version that exists today, and we're not doing something by allowing the federal government to change the law later and change Oregon law without you knowing about it. And the last suggestion I had is, after thinking about this a little while, we are protecting disabled veterans from unconscionable tactics. We're protecting service members who are deployed and their spouses from unconscionable tactics. But what about disabled service members, people that have been disabled by their service? They are still being treated by the military, and they haven't been discharged yet, so they're not a disabled veteran. It might be advisable to include them, even though I think there would be very few of them, there would be very few that we'd have to deal with, but it would seem to make some sense to include a disabled service member along with disabled veterans. And I open for questions if you have any.
Thank you. I'm looking at this, and these suggested amendments that you're speaking of are not included in the Dash 1 amendments?
Correct. Except for number 1, which takes the place of number 1.
Okay. I was unaware that we had more amendments coming into this bill, so we've requested paperwork from, you know, our whole team of fiscal agents, revenue agents, so we won't be able to work this bill this time. Unfortunately, because of that, if these are things that we need, changes we need to make. I think Representative Wingert had the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pretty basic question. Can you give me an example of an unconscionable practice, some kind of a scam or abuse of a veteran or a disabled veteran or their spouse that could occur that would not currently be illegal or actionable, that this bill would now allow that member the ability to get some satisfaction from? I guess I'm trying to figure out what the problem is that we're trying to solve. That's basically my question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert. It's kind of a tough hypothetical. The unconscionable tactic, as I said, is enforced by an attorney general or district attorney. So we're talking about pretty bad conduct. We are anticipating, with all of the returning veterans, service members, some disabled, coming back from our current ventures into the world, that we're likely to have consumers that are going to need a little more protection than other people. And that's the general premise of what we're asking for. A specific kind of thing, you know, over the years there's been a lot of attempts to, what I'm thinking of is my own experience. I was in the military trying to sell insurance. Insurance sales is not a good example because it's not under the UTPA. But as an example, there were a lot of scams toward the end of the Vietnam War era trying to sell insurance at rates that would never either, they wouldn't be paid off, they would be highly, they were charging the veterans much more than the general public. That's just something I remember. We don't have, I didn't make up any list of hypotheticals like that. I don't know which ones I could say would exist in this bill that would. Mr. Kramer, do you have any thoughts on that?
I can't read your unconscionable.
Yeah.
They more
what's all that?
I don't know.
I thought you were conversing to answer. Give me a further answer.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I just I don't have any problem whatsoever with the idea of adding the protection. I'm just trying to get in my mind what it is that can happen to a service member now that they don't have a remedy for, that passing this bill would allow them now to have a remedy for. I mean, I guess I'm concerned that the bill just simply creates another protected class of some kind or another without it really changing the fact that they may have already had a right of action anyway. I'm just trying to figure out what the need for the bill is.
Maybe General Caldwell, who's approached the mic, can help answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Representative Wingard, to your question, I think many times what we see, particularly with credit card rates and families that are perhaps a spouse is deployed, and suddenly credit card rates bounce to 24-36%, something of that nature. The SCRA does apply to that, but in order to get action against that, you're going to have to use the federal attorney to do that. So you're not going to be able to reach out at your local hometown attorney. You got to go to Portland. You got to figure out how that. We're basically all over Oregon, and the family member then is stressed out, can't deal with it, and they ultimately end up paying those rates, and they don't push back and say, "Wait a minute, I'm protected under the SCRA." And what this does is basically give them an Oregon remedy that they can go to their local hometown attorney in Burns, Oregon, and that local attorney can then say, "Wait a minute, we've got the same protection in Oregon law now. You can't do this, Mr. Credit Card Company." And we can tell the Attorney General that, and then the Attorney General can take action against that credit card company. We've seen a lot of this. We've deployed almost 7,000 Oregonians since this war started. So, and we're going to deploy 3,000 more. So we're going to have, and some of them are multiple deployments, a total number of actual soldiers, the Oregon National Guard, going into Title X service, going to war, has been right at 7,000, and it's going to grow. And we're not going to be out of it for a few years. So I think what this bill does is basically gives us a local remedy inside this state so we can enlist the Attorney General of this state to go to bat for our soldiers and their families while they're deployed in the service of the country. So I think it's an excellent, excellent deal just for that alone. And we've got all kinds of things that have happened. Car loans, house loans, you name it, soup to nuts, we see it.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. So in those examples, it's specifically because of their veteran status or they were a spouse of a veteran that occurred to them, or I guess I'm trying to verify that these are stories of people trying to take advantage of veterans because they know the situation they're in and they're trying to take advantage of them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wingard, I think in most cases what you'd find is an ignorance on the part of young families. The spouse who, the ones we see typically, they pretty much fall in a category where the spouse who's handled most of the financial aspects of that family is no longer there to do that. That young mother, or in some cases it's the male, who never handled the household books. They don't know how to pay bills. They don't know how to do a lot of things. And they get in trouble. And they get behind, and they get suddenly, and they're easy prey because they obviously have an emotional setup now that has been disrupted because of the deployment, and people prey on these folks. I mean, they know that they're vulnerable, and so they take advantage of that. So I think, again, in our eyes, it enlists the Attorney General of this state to represent our soldiers when they're in the federal service and they're deployed away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, thank you for joining us. I think maybe it might be a little easier for you to deal with some of the questions. And would it be fair to say that some of our situations we've been finding are a bit unique because of our situation of not having a military base within the state of Oregon? Rather, we have deployed soldiers who don't have the families at home don't have that support system that one might find on the base and enable them to better utilize federal law which is part of the reasoning behind this. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowan, indeed, I think we call ourselves Fort Oregon, and we go all the way from Ontario to Newport, from Milton Free Water to Coos Bay. So we cross the state, and we have every units of every stripe and color throughout the state of Oregon. And indeed, when you have that situation, it's not as easy for our family members then to, one, get together and discuss these things as it is on an active duty base where they can literally go down and sit through the classes. They have the instructions. They have people there. I will say this. The Oregon Bar Association has done yeoman's work throughout these deployments. They have volunteered countless hours to assist our members and their families for just this sort of thing, and we're very grateful for that. This is all pro bono. They've done it for free, and that's helped us greatly. But indeed, your characterization of our issue is quite on point.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would mention that in another committee we have also advanced a piece of legislation that expands the ability of that pro bono program because we're recognizing this problem. So it does seem that if we have additional lawyers willing to step up and provide this assistance, if we could get some of that work done within the state, that would be helpful.
Indeed. And I would also say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cowan, is that this is not widespread. This is not an epidemic out here. We have isolated cases. We typically, I would say on an average deployment of a battalion, which is 600 people, I'm going to see probably five or six of these. So it's a fairly small number. But usually when we get them, when I see them, they're pretty profound. They have really got some problems, and things have spun out of control, and it takes a lot of effort to get it back on track.
Thank you. Egregious that anybody would treat veterans that way to start with, and five or six too many. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After listening to everything, and as everybody here knows that I do have a son in the military, listening to this and even the examples brought forward and knowing that it's only five or six, I don't know if this is going to do anything because I don't think they're being taken advantage of. They're making poor decisions, and I don't know if we can write laws to protect people from their own ignorance. And I can't see where there's a credit card company saying, oh, I'm going after service members only. And for me, I would almost rather see intentionally takes advantage, because if a guy's repeatedly focusing on military members, yeah, then they're doing it. But if it's someone just making, oh, my husband's off, I'm going to run all my credit cards up, and then we go in and bail him out for a spouse making a bad choice, or maybe he does it before he leaves knowing he's going to get a benefit from it or protection. This is one I have a little troubles with now that I'm getting into it and listening to the situations when we talk about it and the aspect that we're talking about in the financial world. So if you have other examples, but for me it's more where someone's focusing on military, then I could support something like this.
Chair Holby, if I might, Dave Kramer, Representative Widener, let me add my two cents worth here. The proposed bill really addresses two distinctly different problems when you get down to it. The first set of problems is the one that Chair Holby sort of talked about, which would hopefully be a minimal number, but that's where the Attorney General, for example, is dealing with the lowest common denominator, slime, predatory business person you can imagine. And those persons are out there. They are out there, and they are targeting vulnerable groups, which is why the UTPA, in general, without this amendment, has special protections for particularly vulnerable groups. So in other words, for example, you'd be very familiar with the kind of predatory practice that we would identify the people who are older folks, and perhaps widows or widowers, and once I identify that market base as a demographic,
I know which buttons to push and which practices to implement, that I can take advantage of those folks in a way that's not specifically described in that laundry list in the UTPA. The same fundamental premise applies to deploy service persons, and particularly the spouses left back home. So in other words, it is, I think, it's probably not accurate to conclude that there are only four or five cases, four or five bubbled up. I think that's probably a function as much as anything, is that there are no special protections for those vets, no incentives, if you will, no word of mouth or advertising to those vets to tell them they have these kind of protections and their family. But more importantly, the predators are out there, and they would be addressed by this part that talks about unconscionable activity. The second part of the concept, if you will, which is entirely different, is the one I think you're probably talking about. The SCRA, as it exists, does not. It has a lot of consumer protections, but they're really in the nature of perks rather than protections against a predator, if you will. They're perks in the sense of, if you're a deployed service person, for example, your interest rates get capped at 6%. All right. Why is that? Because the federal government's made a policy call that if you've been in that circumstance, your finances are shot, your personal world's coming unraveled, mom and poor dad are at home trying to deal with this. So the Congress has said, listen, we're going to give you a number of perks, if you will, that are focused on making that transition easier. One of those is to lower the interest rate on consumer debt. So the consumer debt problem you're talking about, you're right, I don't think there's any widespread move afoot that I'm familiar with, at least, where a credit card company is going to go after deployed people. So that's not a problem that's in search of a solution. The problem is where, on a smaller scale, usually, at least in my experience as a judge advocate, those protections by the SCRA, those perks, if you will, to which they're entitled to, are not provided routinely by some companies, usually the middle-tier companies, lower-tier companies, either because they don't know they're supposed to do those things or because they just know they've got more leverage than the consumer slash military person. And so when I know as a staff judge advocate, when I would write those people and say, listen, my member has, can't afford this bill, that the interest rate needs to be reduced, the statute says so. Usually, again, the communication was enough to solve the problem, but often it wasn't. Often it was a matter of leverage by the lower common denominators, and they would tell me, thank you very much, Captain, Major, whoever, good luck, because you can't sue me. You're a military lawyer. You're not authorized to go into the courts and do these things. I know that. So you don't have any leverage over me. So goodbye. Now, that problem is particularly bad in Oregon for the reasons already stated, because there's not even that judge advocate, if you will, to intervene. So what we're suggesting on that second set of issues, the ones that arise from the SCRA, is that why don't we put those provisions in the UTPA? Why don't we give the Attorney General the authority to police this? And then, frankly, the thinking is that by virtue of doing that, there is leverage, people know it, the problem starts taking care of itself.
Right.
And you really are left with just that really small number, just hopefully low-tier folks who are just predators.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think you've made the point sufficient enough for this chair, and I appreciate your testimony on this. I really do need to keep moving.
One little question to them, but to you.
Representative Krieger.
Is it faster not to move this bill and get the amendment and get a new revenue, is it faster to send it over and get the amendment and have it put in over there? If we save a day or two at the time frame, I don't know. It's up,
We can't move it today anyway, so I'm going to prefer. These are kind of substantial amendments, and I just need to get this taken care of. I get you know, sometimes we get a lot of flack for sending things over that need more than just minor adjustments. So, as much as I hate to, I wish we would have had these proposed suggested amendments days ago, because it is late in the process. Another week later, and I would be forced to do that because the bill would die if we didn't move it.
Never got it.
So, unfortunately, we don't have those amendments before us. But I want to get the public hearing done today, if possible. And a gentleman from the Attorney General's office, thank you very much. And hopefully you can work expeditiously with Representative Matthews to get this accomplished. And General Caldwell, if you'd like to sit right there, I'm going to call up a couple others that you may want to add to, or yes, your choice.
Yes, sir. I'll sit here. My jag, right?
Jim Willis. is signed up, and Brian Leibel. I don't know if I said that correctly. Yeah. Hope I did.
Not a bad name for a lawyer, right?
Hey, Leibel. Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here to speak to the portion of the bill that talks about disabled veterans and their spouses, specifically to the kinds of scams that have been run on our disabled veteran population in our state and their spouses. First of all, you need to understand that in Oregon we have some 42,000 disabled veterans currently living in our state, an additional something close to 30,000 spouses. So we have an at-risk population of some 72,000 that could be impacted in this way. And I'll just give you two quick examples of actual real-world things that happen. One, and probably the most egregious, are people who contact a veteran and in the course of the usually telephone conversation make a determination as to the percentage of disability. Let's say that that percentage is 40% service-connected disabled. What the person will represent on the phone is that they will be able to get an increase in their service-connected disability, and that will cost, of course, an amount of money. That is absolutely illegal. We have federally accredited veteran service officers working for the major veteran organizations, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and the county veteran service officers who provide that service free of charge as part of the public policy of our state in paying to have those services provided to the veteran. So anyone who preys upon these spouses or disabled veterans claiming for a fee that they can raise the amount of disability is committing out-and-out fraud, and they're knowingly doing it. It's being done with intent. The process for reexamination for a disabled veteran is very clear with the federal VA. It happens all the time. And yes, people do get their disability raised. But there's a process for it. And by the way, it doesn't cost money. It's part of the services that we provide to the veteran. So by making this representation to a spouse or a veteran and then seeking a check for payment of such services is... Well, I believe there's a word in the bill that's unconscionable, and I agree with that entirely. The second one that I would just like to mention is the business of providing implements that are in support of a disabled veteran, such as an electric wheelchair, any kind of a walker device, even down to something as simple as a custom-made cane, where people will go out and actually measure people for these devices, and what they charge is far above market rate. And it's not quality material, but the veteran's stuck in their home. They generally just pay, and then later we hear about it, and of course it's after the fact. They've already fled with the funds, or they've taken a check as a down payment for a really nice electric wheelchair that they've left a brochure about, which, by the way, is a brochure from a legitimate company that they have nothing to do with. They just leave the brochure with the veteran, they take a down payment check, and they're gone. That's an absolute fraud. So there's just two quick examples about how, from my standpoint as Director of Veterans Affairs, this statute would be very helpful to us in further prosecuting these folks for this kind of behavior. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Leibel, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Captain Brian Leibel, and I am a full-time judge advocate with the Oregon National Guard and have been so since 2004. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Bar's Military Assistance Panel. For the past 5 years, most of my time has been dealing with soldier legal issues that crop up in and around deployment. I think that House Bill 3020 would provide benefit to service members and their spouses in a time where, I think I've heard prior testimony, where they're probably more vulnerable or susceptible to being leaned on, taken advantage of. Specifically, the bill allows a violation of the SCRA to also violate the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I think that is significant in that the SCRA provisions are triggered when the citizen soldiers are called to service. And whether it's federal service or whether it's responding to a natural emergency and taking them away from home, whether it's your Hurricane Katrina's of the world or whatnot. Those sorts of events have a tendency to disrupt the household in which Congress has recognized and put these SCRA provisions in effect to help with that disruption. It's when, and this is what sets service members apart from your ordinary citizens, is that they get these protections because of their situation. And there might be some bad actors that are reluctant to honor or adhere to those protections, specifically the interest rate reduction. Many service members and their spouses greatly rely upon that. Because you're now, a lot of times you might have a service member that makes more as a civilian and makes less as a service member. And in order to equalize that financially, you have a 6% interest rate reduction. Many times I've had personal experience in working with service members and their spouses and working with creditors or lenders trying to get that interest rate reduction, trying to get them to comply with the SCRA with little to no impact because there's no teeth. And that's just one example. So I think it would be of great benefit to have these SCRA protections. While there might be federal penalties involved, it's here you would have Oregon being able to act on these violations, and where the Attorney General could take a bad actor, because if he's doing it to one service member, he's probably doing it to a number of others.
Thank you. Thank you. General Caldwell, any comments, further comments?
Mr. Chairman, I would just comment on what Brian said here, just to give you just one quick story. Right after 911, we mobilized the 123rd, 142nd, actually, the air base of Portland, and they were mobilized for over a year. And we were flying what is termed as CAP over both Seattle and Portland, which required the whole wing to be stood up. We had a couple of young airmen who had very skilled in computer business, and they worked out at Intel. Both these young men were making somewhere in the neighborhood of $105,000, $110,000. They had a lifestyle built on that. Suddenly, however, they were enlisted in the Air Guard, and suddenly they were ordered to on active duty in their hometown. But they had to go to active duty under this federal order, and their salaries went from around $110,000 down to about $35,000. And, you know, we can all lament about, you know, what it's like to have a cut in pay. That's a pretty steep cut in pay. And yet they had house payments to make. Well, one of them interest rate was more than 6%, and it turned into, and you may have Brian shaking his head, it's turned into a real dogfight. I mean, the mortgage company just refused. They said, no, they're National Guard. They don't get this. And we said, we successfully argued it, but it took 3 to 4 months, and that put incredible stress on that family trying to get that payment lowered so they could stay in their house. So I think anytime we can engage the Attorney General to help our guardsmen, which we work for the governor until we're called by the president to go to the federal service, then I think we should do it. And it just makes good public policy in my mind. So I appreciate your indulgence today, and we'll work with the Attorney General's office to come up with a second set of amendments and get this a much better bill.
Thank you.
Pretty good now.
Yeah, it's pretty good now. And, I thank you so much for your service as well to our veterans as well. And rest assured, I nothing would make me happier than go ahead and move this bill out right now. But I am compelled to hold on to it to try to make these changes. Rest assured, if we are unable to get those amendments back in time, I will move the bill as is over to the other side to make those fixes.
Thank you.
But that's where we stand right now. I will not let this bill die on this side.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger. Do you have any interest in going into work session to adopt the amendment?
No, I do not.
We got it all of it.
We don't have the proper amendments.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to let you know, too, just in light of the last 15 minutes here, my legislative aide is working on, Andy Darkins is with our folks, just left them, actually, and there is a draft heading over to LC now that will get that process started. So we'll fast-track this and do our best to get that done. Yeah. I really appreciate your commitment, and thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3020 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2911. Victoria, would you give us a preview of House Bill 2911?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2911 requires owner of self-service storage facility to dispose of property subject to lien in a manner reasonably intended to realize proceeds close to market value of property if the owner receives no bids in the sale of the property.
Could I have up Representative Barton and Michael Silvelgio, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2911 is closes a small but potentially important loophole in essentially the law of liens in Oregon. So whenever somebody performs services or provides services that then go unpaid, it often creates a lien. Common examples would be a landlord's lien, for example, when there's unpaid rent, or a construction lien, or a mechanics lien. Similarly, there is a self-storage lien. For those self-storage units, when people store property, and that property, if they do not pay it. There is a process for that it creates a lien in the property, the contents within the self-storage unit. And there is already a process in law for when that property is potentially abandoned. For example, someone doesn't pay anymore to the self-storage unit to liquidate that. The current, what this bill essentially does is that in self-storage unit liens, there is a quirk in that if there's potential windfall profit, the self-storage unit owner retains all of that windfall profit. This bill would essentially take that quirk out, bring it out in line with other areas of lien law, such that that windfall profit goes to the state and to the school fund. That said, I would love to turn it over to Mr. Salvaggio from the Treasurer's Office.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's not up to him to turn it over, is it? It's up to you.
It was a question to the chair if it was okay with him if I do that. Thank you, though, Representative.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Gilliam. I nodded and turned it over already before you made a comment. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Just hate to see you get ran over, Chair.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Silvaggio with the Office of the State Treasurer. The bill functions as the good representative has described. What we've done here is a relatively small change to ORS 87.691, subsection 7, which has a clause in it that is unique with regard to Oregon's neighboring states, California, Washington, Idaho, and almost unique with regards to Oregon, the rest of Oregon statute, that says that if unclaimed 2 years after the date of sale, the balance of proceeds minus, of course, what was owed to the storage unit owner become property of the owner without further recourse by the occupant. And when we worked with Representative Barton's office to get this bill drafted, we talked with the Self-Storage Association, who had obvious concerns as they were going to be the primary stakeholders in this legislation. We have an email from them that says that they have discussed 2911 with several of our Oregon members, and we have no objection to a change in the law that would treat sale funds in excess of the owner's lien as unclaimed property that would escheat to the state. That is a policy that's also supported by the Department of State Lands Unclaimed Property Manager, who I believe is here with testimony as well. The Department of State Lands has given this bill a minimal fiscal impact, and I will put on the record that in working with the Self-Storage Association, they did have a concern with the original bill that I believe was addressed in the Dash 2 amendments, so we prefer the Dash 2 amendments be added on before the bill is moved out. And I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding that or any other element of our testimony.
Mr. Chair, it occurs to me, I do not believe I introduced myself for the record. My name is Brent Barton. I represent House District 51.
Thank you, Mr. Barton, for catching that. Representative from what district?
House District 51.
Okay. Boring. Thank you. Patrick Tate? Mr. Salvaggio, do you mind sitting for a few more minutes in case there is a question?
Sure.
We could have asked Representative Barton, but I chose not to have him answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tate, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Patrick Tate, the Unclaimed Property Manager with the Department of State Lands Unclaimed Property Section. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2911.
Short, concise. Yeah. Any questions?
I do.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, just the man I wanted to talk to. I have another issue I'll talk to you separately about. But I want to understand what happens to this unclaimed property, and I think it would benefit everyone, including the listening public, to understand that when this is turned over, it ends up in a, it's my understanding that it ends up in a fund, but do people have an unlimited amount of time to eventually come in and claim it? Exactly how does this work once a storage owner or a bank depositor has turned this over to the Division of State Lands?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, what happens with unclaimed property, it's a really great program. We have there's no time limit for them to come back and reclaim the funds. We maintain an online searchable database where they can actually search for their selves or relatives and let them know about it. If they do find their name, they can file that claim fairly easily, and we will actively process that through for them. And so that's the beauty of it, is that there really is no time limit once it's reported to us. What this bill does in our regard is we don't anticipate this will happen very often, but for those few circumstances where a person would have some money coming back, it would flow into us, and we would be the central point for them to look for those funds that are due them.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. So help us understand what happens to the money when you receive it. Does it then go out and get spent, and you simply have a budget for what you anticipate is the amount of people who will eventually figure out they're owed something and you pay out, or are you holding this money?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, what happens with it is it is deposited into the Common School Fund. The school fund benefits from that by the interest that's earned on those funds as they're invested. What happens to it, if there is a claim against it, we do maintain a revolving trust where the funds come back out again and be reimbursed to that owner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
The wording in the dash 2, lines 6 through 8, relative of the owner or an associate of the relative of the employee may not acquire directly or indirectly property that is subject to disposal under this section. So if you're checking for 2 years to do something and you find out this relative, they don't have right to it?
And I would, to my understanding of this part of it, that probably would not impact us directly in unclaimed property, but I think it's a provision to prevent the situation where maybe something was sold from a storage warehouse where it was not there was not a public offering.
Chair Holden, members of the committee, I'll reintroduce myself. My name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. The dash 2 amendments, the subsection referenced by the good representative, refers to what happens when property in a storage unit is put up for auction and there are no bids on it. The bill then says in, it's dealt with in section 1, subsection 5, that the property is then disposed of at the sole discretion of the owner of the storage unit. However, to be more consistent with Washington's law, which seeks to prevent any funny games regarding valuable items in the, that may be found in the unit, the actual storage unit owner and his immediate family are ineligible to receive those items. It does not preclude family members or heirs from claiming anything from unclaimed property.
All right, you're talking about the relative of the storage unit owner, not the relatives of the person's property.
Shareholder Representative Krieger, that is correct. And if I may clarify, in the discussions that we've had with the bill, the reference to owner, and I've been confused myself a few times about this, but the references to the owner typically refer to the owner of the storage unit, and references to the renter refer to the person who's owning the contents but renting the unit.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the dash 2 amendments. The line 4 of the dash 2 amendments, it says delete line 27 and insert the owner. It doesn't seem that that's really what was meant.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, the dash 2 amendments address the concerns brought forth by the Self-Storage Association. The original bill, as you can see on lines 26 through 27 on page 1, created a process where the owner needed to use a manner reasonably intended to realize proceeds close to the market value of the property. They were, we believe, rightfully concerned at the vagueness of such a statement. We had an example brought forth in our discussions with legislative counsel regarding if someone has a rare stamp that in a storage unit that doesn't fetch any bids at an auction, yet may still have a market value if the owner takes the expense and effort of going on eBay or traveling around to rare stamp dealers. We didn't want to impose that kind of responsibility.
Got it. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I'm not sure that my question was very clear. So can you read me what the amendment would say then if it were inserted in 2911? Starting on line 26 or maybe 25.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I will start at the period on line 26. Actually, what I will do is I will state section subsection 5 as I understand. If the owner receives no bids at the public sale held under this section, the owner may otherwise dispose of the property in the sole discretion of the owner. The owner may satisfy the lien created by ORS 87.687 and reasonable expenses associated with the disposition of the proceeds with this disposition from the proceeds of the disposition, but hold the balance, if any, for delivery on demand to the occupant. I believe what LC has done is they did not have to delete the phrase of the owner on line 27, but did that for style purposes.
Follow up, I'm still confused.
Representative Tomei?
Yes. So could you read that again? Read section 5. If the owner receives no bids at the public sale held under this section, the owner may otherwise dispose of the property in...
Chair Holby, Representative Tomei, the text that has been omitted in the original draft of the bill has been restored pursuant to the Dash 2 amendments. So that phrase would remain in current statute, even though it's in italics in the original draft.
So it would stay in, and so the Dash 2 amendment is incorrect. Is that correct?
I believe the Dash 2 amendments specifically restore that language.
Do you have the Dash 2 in front of you?
For some reason, the owner picks up.
Yes, in line 26, restore the practice.
Chair, line 2 of the dash 2 amendments, it says restore the bracketed material and delete the bold-faced line, but then you have to put back in the owner to make the sentence.
Right. Yeah.
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is the committee clear on that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody but the chair.
Well, I thought I was clear on it when I read it earlier. So, any other questions on this short, simple bill? I appreciate.
Drag it out any longer on Friday?
No, I hope not. I'm trying not to. I've been trying to move expeditiously here, but want to make sure we're doing a thorough job. So, no other questions, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony on this, and no one else has signed up to testify on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2911 and open a work session on House Bill 2911. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2911.
Senator Riley moves the Dash 2 amendments be adopted to House Bill 2911. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Dash 2 amendments are so adopted to House Bill 2911. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2911 as amended to the floor of the due-pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2911 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that this is a bill sponsored by Representative Barton, and it's important to him. Is that true?
Thank you for that. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wingert.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Widener. Not with me between.
No, but I reserve the right to vote yes on the floor.
Oh my God.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2911, having received the required votes, declared passed. Representative Barton, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
That I close the work session on House Bill 2911 and open a work session on House Bill 2578. Victoria, will you please preview the House Bill 2578 before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2578, as it was originally drafted, would have required parking facility owners to affix notice on vehicle and wait 2 hours before having the vehicle towed. It would have obliged towers to release the vehicle without charge if the owner was present at the time of the tow, and it would have provided for denial of revocation of towing business certificate for any tower that accepted or provided compensation based on the number of vehicles towed. As you will recall, the committee adopted a the Dash 2 amendments last Wednesday, which replaced the two-hour notice with a requirement for contact with property owner, owner's agent, or tenant, created exceptions for vehicles constituting a safety hazard, blocking access, or without parking tag in residential lots with fewer parking spaces than units, required photographic evidence of improperly parked vehicles, obliges owner tower to release vehicle if owner is present at the time of the tow without charge, or if hookup is complete for a fee that does not exceed the hookup charge, requires landlords to post signs in each designated guest parking space listing any rules, restrictions, or limitations on guest parking, and it deleted the prohibition against compensation based on the number of vehicles towed.
So we would be considering the Dash 2 amendments?
We already adopted them.
We already adopted those. Okay. Mr. Elkins, I know we had a very short public hearing. We are in work session. I accommodate you if you want to come up and talk. You're fine. Representative Riley, any comments you'd like to give on this bill?
Just very briefly, there is a small piece that got left out of the exceptions, and that is a red curb saying no parking, and the people who want that are okay with putting that in the Senate, and so we can go ahead with that. I move House Bill 2578 to the floor and do pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2578 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
I appreciate the representative from Hillsborough's time on this. I have some concerns about the bill, and I'll start with the designated sign, a sign in each guest space, and the cost that I believe that may place on a residential apartment complex that could have hundreds of spots. And it seems unnecessary to have that kind of signage. It's almost sign pollution to have a sign like that in every single parking space. I do like the idea of requiring the towing companies to take a picture and to keep a photograph, and I think that actually is a great element of the bill that I would be very happy to support. I am concerned also about this notice, and it would be helpful to me if Representative Riley could help me out with this, how this notice is supposed to work, say at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. I mean, in a lot of cases, folks have turned over to the towing company the ability to do this because they do not want to be called at 2 or 3 in the morning when a car is illegally parked.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Yeah, we went through this in great detail for over two meetings, and it was agreed to by the Apartment Owners Association in consultation with their members. And the signage is, first of all, not for every space, it's for guest spaces only.
Okay.
And that was part of the agreement, it's for guest spaces only. As to the not wanting to be called in the middle of the night, they want to turn over this to somebody else. I understand that, and that was a long series of discussions. And if we're talking about apartment complexes, the spaces that have the most problems are the spaces that are assigned. And the apartment owner would not have to do anything about that. The person who wants their space back has to deal with that. So that was the agreement there. It's the person who's assigned the space who gets the contact and gets the car towed.
Other questions?
One more comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
We're getting ready to vote on this bill. I am going to support this compromise because the parties came together, worked it out. I'm personally concerned about some of the elements of this bill, but I'll honor the compromise that they've worked out. I just want to be on the record as saying that I believe that a great deal of the problem we're seeing in the metropolitan area as a result of the predatory towing, or what people think is pretty hardcore towing, comes from a lack of parking space availability in our communities. And that is a direct result, that is a purposeful result of what Metro has done with its rulemaking. And I can provide everyone in this committee and members of the public evidence in Metro's rules of what they have done to try to limit how many parking spaces are available when somebody develops an apartment complex or develops a commercial building. And I think that that is ultimately the culprit here, and our bill today will not solve that problem. There is a lack of parking space availability for people, and as long as there is that lack, you're going to see fighting essentially over parking spaces or the availability of them, and aggressive towing by the property owners to try to keep what limited parking spaces they have open. And I hope that at some point we take that issue up. With that, I'll shut up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Riley.
I absolutely agree with a lot of what you just said. And we took a lot of that into consideration when we made the special rules for apartment complexes with fewer parking spaces than units. And that was really a big part of why we did that. And I appreciate your comments.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on in kind of a secondary role on this work group, and I would just say this, that I remember when I worked at Willamette University many years ago, and I remember the president commenting that it was easier for us to raise several multi-million dollar buildings and open the School of Management than it was each year to deal with everybody's opinions on the parking procedures at Willamette University. We'll see a bill. We saw this last time. And we'll see it again. And it's not because Representative Riley didn't put together a good package. It's just because there are, as Representative pointed out, there are as many situations as there are commercial buildings and houses and cars and individual situations. It's very complicated, and it gets down to the nitty-gritty of lots of really strange individual situations. And that's why I said he was courageous. He just wouldn't be deterred by small, important, but small individual situations. And he moved ahead, and that's why this hearing room is basically empty. Because it was a great exercise in having folks, unlike, let's say, the Puppy Mill or something like that. It was a great exercise in people coming together and agreeing. We'll see another bill, because there'll be another loophole or maybe another situation, but it's a good bill.
Should tell us what we do.
Yes, thank you. I wouldn't the Puppy Mill as an example of something that didn't happen. We spent many hours on that bill as well with the work group.
With Ron, it was just
Representative Gilliam. No follow up with you, Brian. hard to believe, but we worked very hard in this committee, and sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't. But needless to say, we still work hard to try to get it right.
We certainly do.
To the bill, real quick, please.
Representative.
I want to get out here as bad as anybody. But, follow up on Representative Wingate's comment here. Operate of a motor vehicle in each parking stall. Or at each entrance to the parking facility. But it's saying a sign posted clearly readable by an operator of a motor vehicle in each parking stall.
You're reading the wrong section. Never mind. I'll give you that. Whatever.
Okay. I'm ready to vote on it. I saw that too. And
well, thank you.
That's in the -2 amendment.
I appreciate Representative Riley's work on this. I think it's a great piece of legislation, and we'll note that the Building Owners and Managers Association of Portland and their request to look at that one small piece they felt was left out in Section 2, Subsection 3, which would have been subparagraph E, vehicles parked in areas marked with red curbs, no parking or loading only zones, be addressed on the Senate side. For the record, and I appreciate Representative Riley's hard work on this issue. It was a tough bill, and
and appreciate all the hard work. And Representative Gilliam, I appreciate your volunteering for serving on that work group as well. And I noticed that your attendance has improved since that. So with that, Representative, or yep. Any other comments, questions? Cindy, may we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Oh, Mr. Chair. Those comments. Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Representative Wingate votes aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
The chair votes aye. House Bill 2578, having received the required votes, declare passed the floor with due pass recommendation. Representative Riley, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Please.
Representative Riley carried the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2578. And we are carrying House Bill 3085 over to Monday, which would be April 13th. Committee, with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.